Greetings, this is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia, and this is another in this series of readings from and brief notes and commentary upon Augustine of Hippo's Harmony of the Evangelists. This episode is a continuation of the series after a fairly significant break. It's been about 4 months since I recorded an episode. I'm resuming it today in hopes that we might be able to persevere and complete it, although it's going to take a while to work through the entire book. I had some things come up right at the end of last year that had some other projects I was working on that sort of didn't allow me the time to continue. And I was reminded of the words about Augustine's Harmony Evangelist that were written by S.F.D. Salmond in his introduction to the work. And he called it one of Augustine's most toilsome works. And it may feel a bit like that if you were previously listening to the first, I think, 8 episodes in the series. After he provides in Book 1 some preliminary information on the Gospels, he sort of turns, and a lot of the rest of Book 1 is about apologetics. And he provides some rather tedious, I think, treatments of Christian apologetics over against pagan polytheistic religion. Again, it might seem tedious or toilsome to us, but of course, I think it was probably very important work that Augustine was doing with respect to Christian apologetics in his time. So we are going to resume the series today, and hopefully we'll be able to work through it and see if we can work our way through to the end eventually. From this point on, I'm going to be doing these episodes also only in an audio format. I'm not going to put up a video version of it. And so the audio version, obviously, if you're listening to this, this is where you're going to hear it, will be found on sermonaudio.com. So without any further ado, let's resume the series. We're in Book 1, and we're going to be looking at the chapters 22 and 23 from Book 1 of Augustine of Hippo's Harmony of the Evangelists. And so we're at chapter 22, which has the heading of the opinion entertained by the Gentiles regarding our God. Augustine writes, "But why do I interrogate men whose native wit has deserted them in answering the question as to who this God is? Some say that he is Saturn. I fancy the reason of that is found in the sanctification of the Sabbath, for these men assigned that day to Saturn. But their own Varro, than whom they point to no man of greater learning among them, thought that the God of the Jews was Jupiter, and he judged that it mattered not what name was employed, provided the same subject was understood under it, in which, I believe, we see how he was subdued by his supremacy. For inasmuch as the Romans are not accustomed to worship any more exalted object than Jupiter, of which fact their capital is the open and sufficient attestation, and deem him to be the king of all gods, when he observed that the Jews worship the supreme God, he could not think of any object under that title other than Jupiter himself. But whether men call the God of the Hebrews Saturn, or declare him to be Jupiter, let them tell us when Saturn dared to prohibit the worship of a second deity. He did not venture to interdict the worship even of this very Jupiter, who is said to have expelled him from his kingdom, the Son thus expelling the Father. And if Jupiter, as the more powerful deity and the conqueror, had been accepted by his worshippers, then they ought not to worship Saturn, the conquered and expelled. But neither, on the other hand, did Jove put his worship under the ban. Nay, that deity, whom he had power to overcome, he nevertheless suffered to continue a god." Chapter 23, titled, "Of the Follies Which the Pagans Have Indulged in Regarding Jupiter and Saturn." "These narratives of yours," say they, "are but fables which have to be interpreted by the wise, or else they are fit only to be laughed at. But we revere that Jupiter of whom Maro says that, quote, all things are full of Jove, end quote. This is found in Virgil's Eclogues. That is to say, the spirit of life that vivifies all things. It is not without some reason, therefore, that Varro thought that Jove was worshipped by the Jews. For the God of the Jews says by his prophet, I fill heaven and earth. But what is meant by that which the same poet names ether? How do we take the term? For he speaks thus, and this is from Virgil's Georgics. Then the omnipotent father ether, with fertilizing showers, came down into the bosom of his fruitful spouse. They say indeed that this ether is not spirit, but a lofty body in which the heaven is outstretched above the air. Is liberty conceded to the poet to speak at one time in the language of the followers of Plato, as if God was not body, but spirit, and at another time in the language of the Stoics, as if God was a body? What is it, then, that they worship in their capital? If he is a spirit, or if, again, it is, in short, the corporeal heaven itself, then what does that shield of Jupiter there, which they style the Aegis? The origin of that name, indeed, is explained by the circumstance that a goat nourished Jupiter when he was concealed by his mother. Or is this a fiction of the poets? But are the capitals of the Romans then also the mere creation of the poets? And what is the meaning of that certainly not poetical, but unmistakably farcical, veritability of yours in seeking your gods according to the ideas of philosophers in books and revering them according to the notions of poets in your temples? But was that Euhemerus also a poet, who declares both Jupiter himself and his father Saturn and Pluto and Neptune his brothers to have been men in terms so exceedingly plain that their worshippers ought all the more to render thanks to the poets, because their inventions have not been intended so much to disparage them as rather to dress them up? Albeit, Cicero mentions that this same Euhemerus was translated into Latin by the poet Ennius. Or was Cicero himself a poet, who, in counseling the person with whom he debates in his Tusculan Disputations, addresses him as one possessing knowledge of things secret, in the following terms, quote, if indeed I were to attempt to search into antiquity, and produce from thence the subjects which the writers of Greece have given to the world, it would be found that even those deities which are reckoned gods of the higher orders have gone from us into heaven. Ask whose sepulchres are pointed out in Greece. Call to mind, since you have been initiated, the things which are delivered in the mysteries. Then, doubtless, you will comprehend how widely extended this belief is. End quote. This author certainly makes ample acknowledgement of the doctrine that these gods of theirs were originally men. He does indeed benevolently surmise that they made their way into heaven. But he did not hesitate to say in public that even the honor thus given them in general repute was conferred upon them by men, when he spoke of Romulus in these words, quote, by good will and repute, we have raised to the immortal gods that Romulus who founded this city. End quote. How should it be such a wonderful thing, therefore, to suppose that the more ancient men did with respect to Jupiter and Saturn, and the others what the Romans have done with respect to Romulus? And what, in good truth, they have thought of doing even in these more recent times, also in the case of Caesar? And to these same Virgil has addressed the additional flattery of song, saying in his Eclogue, lo, the star of Caesar, descendant of Dion, arouse. Let them see it, then, that the truth of history do not turn out to exhibit to our view sepulchres erected for their false gods here upon the earth, and let them take heed lest the vanity of poetry, instead of fixing, may be feigning stars for their deities there in heaven. For in reality that one is not the star of Jupiter, neither is this one the star of Saturn. But the simple fact is that upon these stars, which were set from the foundation of the world, the names of those persons were imposed after their deaths by men who are minded to honor them as gods on their departure from this life. And with respect to these, we may indeed ask how there should be such ill desert in chastity, or such good desert in voluptuousness, that Venus should have a star, and Minerva be denied one among those luminaries which revolve along with the sun and moon. But it may be said that Cicero, the academic sage, who had been bold enough to make mention of the sepulchres of their gods and to commit the statement to writing, is a more doubtful authority than the poets. although he did not presume to offer that assertion simply as his own personal opinion, but put it on record as a statement contained among the traditions of their own sacred rites. Well, then, can it also be maintained that Varro either gives expression merely to an invention of his own, as a poet might do, or puts the matter only dubiously, as might be the case with an academician, because he declares that, in the instance of all such gods, the matters of their worship had their origins either in the life which they lived or in the death which they died among men. Or was that Egyptian priest, Leon, either a poet or an academician, who expounded the origin of those gods of theirs to Alexander of Macedon, in a way somewhat different, indeed, from the opinion advanced by the Greeks, but nevertheless so far accordant therewith as to make out their deities to have been originally men. But what is all this to us? Let them assert that they worship Jupiter and not a dead man. Let them maintain that they have dedicated their capital not to a dead man, but to the spirit that vivifies all things and fills the world. And as to that shield of his, which was made of the skin of a she-goat in honor of his nurse, let them put upon it whatever interpretation they please. What do they say, however, about Saturn? What is it that they worship under the name of Saturn? Is not this the deity that was the first to come down to us from Olympus, of whom the poet sings in Virgil's Aeneid? Then from Olympus's height came down good Saturn, exiled from his crown by Jove, his mightier heir. He brought the race to union first, erstwhile on the mountain tops dispersed, and gave them statutes to obey, and willed the land wherein he lay should Latium's title bear. Does not his very image, mazed as it is with the head covered, present him as one under concealment? Was it not he that made the practice of agriculture known to the people of Italy, a fact which is expressed by the reaping hook? No, say they. For you may see whether the being of whom such things are recorded was a man, and indeed one particular king. We, however, interpret Saturn to be universal time, as is signified also by his name in Greek, for he is called Kronos, which word, with the aspiration thus given it, is also the vocable for time, whence too in Latin he gets the name of Saturn, as if it meant that he is sated with years. But now, what are we to make of people like these, I know not, who, in their very effort to put a more favorable meaning upon the names and images of their gods, make the confession that the very God, who is their major deity and the father of the rest, is time? For what else do they thus betray, but in fact, that all those gods of theirs are only temporal, seeing that the very parent of them all is made out to be time? Accordingly, their more recent philosophers of the Platonic school, who have flourished in Christian times, have been ashamed of such fancies, and have endeavored to interpret Saturn in another way, affirming that he received the name Kronos in order to signify, as it were, the fullness of intellect, their explanation being that in Greek fullness is expressed by the term kleros, and intellect or mind by the term nous, which etymology seems to be favored also by the Latin name, on the supposition that the first part of the word, Saturnus, came from the Latin, and the second part from the Greek, so that he got the title Saturnus as an equivalent to Satur, nous. For they say how absurd it was to have Jupiter regarded as a son of time, whom they either considered or wished to have considered eternal deity. Furthermore, however, according to this novel interpretation, which it is marvelous that Cicero and Varro should have suffered to escape their notice, if their ancient authorities really had it, they called Jupiter the son of Saturn, thus denoting him, it may be, as the spirit that proceedeth forth from that supreme mind, the spirit which they choose to look upon as the soul of this world, so to speak, filling alike all heavenly and all earthly bodies. Whence comes also that saying of Maro, which I have cited a little ago, namely, all things are full of Jove. Should they not, then, if they are possessed of the ability, alter the superstitions indulged in by men, just as they alter their interpretation, and either erect no images at all, or at least build capitals to Saturn, rather than to Jupiter. For they also maintain that no rational soul can be produced gifted with wisdom, except by participation in that supreme and unchangeable wisdom of his. And this affirmation they advance not only with respect to the soul of a man, but even with respect to that same soul of the world, which they also designate Jove. Now, we not only concede, but even very particularly proclaim, that there is a certain supreme wisdom of God by participation in which every soul, whatsoever that is constituted truly wise, acquires its wisdom. But whether that universal corporeal mass, which is called the world, has a kind of soul, or, so to speak, its own soul, that is to say, a rational life by which it can govern its own movements, as is the case with every sort of animal, is a question both vast and obscure. That is an opinion which ought not to be affirmed, unless its truth is clearly ascertained. Neither ought it to be rejected, unless it is falsehood. Its falsehood is as clearly ascertained. And what will it matter to man, even should this question remain forever unsolved, since in any case no soul becomes wise or blessed by drawing from any other soul, but from that one supreme and immutable wisdom of God. The Romans, however, who have founded a capital in honor of Jupiter, but none in honor of Saturn, as also these other nations whose opinion it has been that Jupiter ought to be worshipped preeminently and above the rest of the gods, have certainly not agreed in sentiment with the persons referred to, who, in accordance with that mad view of theirs, would dedicate their loftiest citadels rather to Saturn, if they had any power in these things, and who most particularly would annihilate those mathematicians and nativity spinners, by whom this Saturn, whom their opponents would designate the maker of the wise, has been placed with the character of a deity of evil among the other stars. But this opinion, nevertheless, has prevailed so mightily against them in the mind of humanity that men decline even to name that god and call him ancient rather than Saturn, and that in so fearful a spirit of superstition that the Carthaginians have now gone very near to change the designation of their town and call it the town of the ancient more frequently than the town of Saturn. Here ends this reading of Book 1 and Chapters 22 and 23, and let's move on to some brief notes and commentary on these two chapters. And we'll begin in Book 1 and Chapter 22, which had the heading of the opinion entertained by the Gentiles regarding our God. In that chapter, Augustine surveys pagan misunderstandings, as he sees them, of the Christian God. Some pagans associate the Christian God with Saturn, and they point to the worship of the Jews on the Sabbath, Saturn's Day or Saturday, and that's why they think that the God of the Bible is Saturn. The famed Roman scholar Varro, however, associated the God of the Jews with Jupiter, and Jupiter was the Roman name. The Greek equivalent of that god would be Zeus. In Roman mythology, Saturn was the father of Jupiter. Saturn ate all of his children at their birth, lest they would usurp him. Jupiter, however, was hidden by his mother, and eventually he attacked his father, conquered and expelled him, and freed his divine siblings from Saturn's body. Jupiter then became the king of all the gods, according to Roman mythology. Augustine argues that whether pagans think the God of the Bible is Saturn or Jupiter is an indifferent matter. In either case, they have a problem. If they think that the God of the Bible is Saturn, how can they reconcile the fact that Saturn never forbade the worship of other gods? If they think that the God of the Bible is Jupiter, then they should remember that according to Roman mythology, even after Jupiter dethroned Saturn, he did not forbid worship of Saturn himself. And so Augustine's point is to point to these logical problems intellectually with the Roman religion, and to show how Christianity is a superior alternative to the confusion of the Roman religions. He continues this theme in Book 1, Chapter 23, which is titled, Of the Follies Which the Pagans Have Indulged in Regarding Jupiter and Saturn. In this chapter, Augustine continues to poke holes in the theology of paganism. He notes that though popular religion relies on the stories of the gods as fables, the more sophisticated see deeper meaning. Their interpretations, however, are not consistent. They speak of the ether, of a great entity that fills the world, but some of them follow a Platonic view and see this ether or God as a spirit and not a body. Others follow a Stoic line of thinking and see this ether as a body and perhaps something like pantheism. He cites writers of the past like a Greek writer, Euhemerus, and the Latin writer, the Roman writer, Cicero, who suggested that the gods were originally men who moved from heaven to earth. So deified men in the way that Romulus was deified and as the Caesars were deified. Nevertheless, Augustine notes that the pagans assert that they worship Jupiter, and they speak of Jupiter as a vivifying spirit that fills the world, and they don't look at their god as a dead man. Saturn, they say, also was not a man, but the equivalent of the Greek god Kronos, representing time. Augustine offers the jibe that by making this defense, the pagans admit that one of their chief gods is literally temporal. He is time. He is in time. And so he would be inferior to the eternal God of the Christians. He notes that the Platonic philosophers have countered the Christians by arguing that Saturn comes from the names for the Greek word for fullness, satis, and the mind or the intellect, the nous. And so Saturn is means fullness of intellect. And because Jupiter is the offspring of Saturn, Jupiter refers to a supreme mind, a spirit that serves as the soul of the world. If this is the case, Augustine retorts, they should tear down the images and the capital in Rome dedicated to Jupiter, and they should instead erect images and the capital to Saturn, because Saturn would be a greater god, the fullness of intellect. Instead, he points out that Saturn is often treated as a maligned deity, even an evil deity by the pagans. Well, in these two chapters, what is Augustine doing? He's continuing to sort of deconstruct the theology and the mythology of paganism, pointing out the rational inconsistencies in pagan intellectual interpretations of the myths of Saturn and Jupiter. His ultimate point will be to suggest that the God of Christianity is in fact superior to the myths of paganism, however one might try to interpret them and make them more intellectually satisfying. And again, the main point is that Augustine is putting forward an apologetic for the rationality of Christianity over against the old Roman religions. Well, this brings this episode to a conclusion. I hope this has been helpful, and I'll look forward to speaking to you in the next episode. Till then, take care and God bless.